Chapter 9. Layering in Extremis. Clothing to Conquer Everest and the South Pole. Of Fur and Burberry. Polar exploration is at once the cleanest and most isolated way of having a bad time which has been devised. It is the only form of adventure in which you put on your clothes at Michaelmas and keep them on until Christmas. Apsley Cherry Garrard, The Worst Journey in the World, 1922. The worst has happened, Robert Falcon Scott wrote in his notebook on Tuesday the 16th of January 1912. Or nearly the worst. The day had started well. Scott and his four companions had managed a respectable 7.5 miles through thick snow and temperatures 23.5 degrees Celsius below freezing. They had been hauling, skiing and dog sledding in poor conditions for 2.5 months and over 1,800 miles. They were frostbitten and fatigued, drawn on only in the hopes of being the first men to reach the South Pole. On that day, their goal was just a scant handful of miles away, and it seemed as if the commendations of history were within their grasp. During the afternoon, however, their wearied footsteps brought them to a dreadful sight. A black flag tied to a sledge-bearer, nearby the remnants of a camp. The Norwegian team had reached the pole before them, and the race was lost. "Great God," Scott wrote, "this is an awful place, and terrible enough for us to have laboured to it without the reward of priority." They walked the final miles in the month-old footsteps of the victors. 10 weeks later, all five men were dead. The very existence of Antarctica remained unproven until the late 18th century. The idea of a hypothetical southern continent, Terra Australis, had been posited in antiquity, and its imagined geographical features were sketched onto maps merely to balance the landmass of the northern hemisphere. In the age of empire, however, the idea of new expanses of land was too tempting not to be explored. An expedition led by James Cook sailed from Plymouth in the summer of 1772 in two ships named Resolution and Adventure. By the 10th of December, he sighted his first Ice Island, an iceberg, and on the 17th of January 1773, the Resolution became the first ship known to have plunged its bow through the Antarctic Circle, a feat it would achieve twice more before returning home. Although the two ships had been kitted out with all the latest equipment to deal with extreme weather, the men aboard had not. As the ship moved further south, it became so cold that the entire crew seemed in jeopardy. Around the time the first iceberg was seen, Cook caused the sleeves of their jackets, which were so short as to expose their arms, to be lengthened with coarse woolen baize, and had a cap made for each man of the same stuff, together with canvas. Once the existence of a southerly landmass was established, its call, siren-like, sounded in the ears of ambitious explorers the world over. The fate of the British Terra Nova expedition is one of the most tragic in the sorry annals of doomed adventure. Many have laid blame for the poor performance of Scott and his companions relative to the Norwegians on their choice of kit. In this view, the British fatally underestimated the demands of the Antarctic climate. This isn't quite true. Scott was alive to the vital importance of clothing and equipment. He had led a previous expedition, the Discovery, from 1901 to 1904, and was the first to admit that mistakes were made. "Food, clothing, everything was wrong," he wrote on his return. "The whole system was wrong." He was determined not to repeat his mistakes. He therefore set about the matter methodically, using his men as guinea pigs in the early parts of the expedition, putting each on a different ratio of fats and carbohydrates, varying their clothing to see which performed best, and weighing them before and after shorter trips to ensure they hadn't lost too much weight. He stressed the importance of each man learning the skills to take care of and improve their own kit. Every minute spent in keeping one's gear dry and free of snow is very well repaid. By Sunday, the 3rd of September 1911, he felt confident that our equipment is the best that has been devised for the purpose. Like all explorers of the heroic age, a period that lasted from the late 19th century into the 1920s, the Terra Nova expedition were reliant on natural fibres, wool, cotton, silk, and fur. Indeed, the British and Norwegian teams had a lot of kit in common. Both had woolen long johns and vests, for example, as well as layers of sweaters, shirts, and corduroy trousers to trap multiple insulating layers of air. Even some of the brands were the same. Woolsey, a British woolen manufacturer, provided both teams with their patented, unshrinkable woolen underwear, mittens, and socks. The firm used a photograph of Scott and his companions wearing their products in an advertising campaign, and he provided them with a personal testimonial. Woolsey was still supplying woolen underwear to Antarctic expeditions as late as 1949, when it was chosen for a Norwegian-British-Swedish expedition, along with hand-knitted Shetland jumpers. Both teams also wore Burberry gabardine suits, a popular choice among early 20th century explorers and mountaineers. Shackleton wore Burberry for the 1901-4 Antarctic expedition and returned to the firm when planning his next assault on the South Pole, which left in 1907. For that trip, he chose one of the brand's top coats over a double-breasted woolen suit made from sturdy pilot cloth and lined with Jaeger fleece. Invented in 1879 by Thomas Burberry and inspired by Hampshire shepherds, who treated their smocks with lanolin to waterproof them, gabardine was at this time the most windproof and innovative cloth available. In essence, it was a tightly woven, light cotton fabric, each thread of which had a weatherproof coating, making it wind and water resistant, but also allowing for some breathability. However, if it rained consistently, or if the snow became slushy, water could leak through the weave to the woolen layers beneath. This was such a problem that many alpinists considered an umbrella essential. The biggest difference between the two teams were their outer layers. The British relied exclusively on the gabardine cloth trousers and coats, while Amundsen's topped these with reindeer or seal parkas and trousers. Amundsen had picked up this style of cold-weather clothing from the Netsilik Inuits while staying in the Arctic years previously, and wrote that any expedition without it would be inadequately equipped. But then he was also relying on dog sledges, so that for a greater part of each day, the five-man team would be sitting down. This meant that they would get colder faster, and the huge weight of the fur suit didn't much matter. For the British team, using other, more labour-intensive forms of transport, and who for the most part hauled their sledges themselves, fur would have had serious drawbacks. "All furs are far too impervious," wrote Edward Wilson, who accompanied Ernest Shackleton and Scott on the Discovery expedition. "And instead of allowing the free evaporation of moisture from the body, collect and absorb it all, and become heavy and wet when frozen. It is a golden rule to avoid anything but wool as far as possible." Scott evidently agreed. Plus fours at 28,000 feet. "Because it's there." George Mallory, when asked why he wanted to climb Everest, New York Times, 1923. On the 1st of May 1999, a body was found high on the north face of Everest. In itself, this was not unusual. The world's highest mountain has wreaked the lives of over 200 mountaineers and Sherpas in the past century. Most lie where they fell, buried under snow or stone-piled cairns if they're lucky, prominently displayed like grisly sculptures on increasingly busy paths if not. The body of Tsewang Palyor, a young Indian climber, has been nicknamed Green Boots by the many climbers who, since his death in 1996, have stepped over his neon-clad remains to reach the summit. The body found on this occasion, however, was different. He lay face down, head uphill, in a pile of scree at 26,760 feet. Strong wind had stripped the layers of fabric from the back of the body, and sun and time had scoured and bleached the exposed flesh as white as the surrounding snow. The arms were outstretched towards the peak, gloveless fingers gripping into gravel as if to halt his slide. The muscles of his back, still defined, stood out still with the effort. Gravel had gathered around the body and frozen, marble hard, immuring it in the mountainside. One hobnail boot-shod leg lay outstretched, the other, terminating in a bone-pale naked calf and heel, lay gently crossed over the first, scraps of thickly knitted sock caught between them. It was the boot that gave the team of seekers a clue as to the age of the body. Hobnail boots hadn't been used much after the mid-1930s, and no climbers that they knew of had died this high up between 1924 and 1938. The murmur of the boots and tattered clothes, made from natural fibres, gave way to a shout of certainty as Tap Richards, an American mountaineer, leafed through the thin layers of fabric still intact at the nape of the neck, a laundry label neatly sewn to a shirt collar. G. Lee Ma. The last man to see George Mallory alive 7 decades previously and live to tell the tale was Noel O'Dell, a fellow mountaineer. He wrote on his return with pride and perhaps a little envy that on the 4th of June 1924, Mallory and his 22-year-old climbing partner, Andrew Sandy Irvine, climbed from camps 3 to 4 in a mere 2.5 hours, pushing themselves and their newfangled oxygen equipment to the limit in preparation for the final assault on the summit. Although the weather conditions had been unsettled, it promised to be perfect for their climb to the summit on the 8th. Mallory told Adele so in a note delivered by a porter the day before, apologising for having upset his cooking stove as they left Camp 5. It had rolled off down the mountain, leaving O'Dell to chew a chilled dinner and breakfast. His final sighting of the pair was at 12:50 p.m. on the day of their bid to be the first men to climb Everest. He was far below them doing some climbing of his own when there was a break in the cloud. "I saw the whole summit ridge and final peak of Everest unveiled. I noticed far away on a snow slope leading up to the last step but one from the base of the final pyramid, a tiny object moving and approaching the rock step. A second object followed, and then the first climbed to the top of the step. As I stood intently watching this dramatic appearance, the scene became enveloped in cloud." At this point, the pair were, O'Dell estimated, around 800 feet below the summit, and should have reached it between 3 and 5:30. The timing troubled O'Dell. Mallory's schedule had put them at these steps at 10 a.m. at the latest. They were hours behind, making it impossible to reach the world's peak and return to Camp 6 before being overtaken by the gloaming. To make matters worse, when O'Dell reached the camp in the early afternoon, the wind picked up and a rather severe blizzard set in, which lasted for nearly 2 hours. O'Dell spent years wondering if Mallory and Irvine had, in those final hours, reached the summit of Everest. The 1924 attempt was Mallory's third, and at 37, he felt it was likely to be his last. He was charming, handsome, and a teacher at a British school, as well as an impressive amateur climber. In a flirtatious letter to a young admirer, he wrote, "We've got to win the top, next time or never." Perhaps realizing how final this sounded, or perhaps to impress his correspondent, he added a more flippant line, "Anyway, it will be a tremendous struggle." This was certainly true. Even the journey to the foothills would involve months of arduous travel, and a 5-week trek across the Tibetan plains, made even more difficult because Golden Age Royal Geographical Society and Alpine Club expeditions rarely packed light. Among the 20-odd tons of luggage borne up the mountain by 300 pack beasts and 70 porters were 4 cases of Montebello champagne and 60 tins of quail and foie gras. Luxurious food and drink aside, preparation and equipment were vital to the attempt, and bids for the summit were planned and spoken of like military campaigns. The lack of a cooking pot, an oxygen tank, a canteen or a rope, wrote one New York Times journalist, may doom the expedition. As experienced climbers, Mallory and his companions knew this, nor were they ignorant of the dangers, humiliations, and disappointments such a trip could pose. The first attempt had cost £6,000, but only managed a relatively ignominious 21,000 feet, although they did find a viable approach. The second had stretched to 27,235 feet at a cost of £11,000, and the lives of 7 porters who had been lost in an avalanche. The previous attempt had been halted by frostbite and exhaustion, and although more care and more experience attended the 1924 expedition, danger was never far away. Days before Mallory's climb in 1924, Howard Somerville, his friend and fellow survivor of the 1922 expedition, reached 28,117 feet before the sore throat and hacking cough that had plagued him throughout the trip nearly ended his life. The mucous membrane lining of his throat had frozen and broken away, become stuck in his windpipe, and was choking him to death. He gave himself the Heimlich manoeuvre, coughed up the obstructing matter along with a lot of blood, and survived. To tackle the extreme cold, the lowest recorded summit temperature is minus 41 degrees Celsius, the climbers used the best they believed was available. This meant layer upon layer of natural fibre clothing, silk and hand-knitted wool, very much a continuation of the style of sporting gentlemen in the Peak District. Photographs of the Mallory team high up in the Himalayas in 1924 show them bundled up in smocks or tweedy jackets with fiddly buttons bulging over thick woolen scarves, Jaeger trousers, and an eccentric assortment of hats, a rakish trilby here, there an astrakhan cap that failed to cover fragile ear tips. They wore elbow-length rib-knitted mittens, thick knee-high socks and hobnail boots. Higher up, the number of layers increased. From the remnants found on his body, we know that for the final ascent, Mallory wore cotton and silk underwear, a flannel shirt from Payne's Outfitters in Godalming, a brown long-sleeved pullover, and a woolen waistcoat lovingly knitted by his wife Ruth. Over his base layers, Mallory wore a Burberry jacket and plus fours made from a sheened green and relatively lightweight gabardine. It's difficult to determine what he made of his garb. It was inculcated with the heroic ideal, and in his writing dwelt more on awe-inspiring vistas and his feelings for his wife and children than on his own physical condition. But perhaps this description from his teammate Edward Norton gives an impression. The weather was ideal, with very little wind. Even so, clad in 2 suits of windproof clothing and 2 sweaters, I found it very cold. Sitting in the sun, I shivered so much that I once thought I had fever on me. Lightness and breathability, however, were crucial. Firstly, the weather could turn on a sixpence, from blazing sunshine to icy blizzards in minutes. Winds at the summit have reached 175 miles per hour, enough to pick a man up and hurl him off the mountain like a toddler with a disfavored rag doll. In a letter to his wife, Mallory described a scorching mist encountered high on a glacier. One seemed literally at times to be walking in a white furnace, he wrote. Morshead, who knows the hottest heat of the plains in India, said that he had never felt any heat so intolerable. Secondly, clothes that were easier to move in meant a faster assault on the summit. This is still vital today. The extreme altitude of the mountain, particularly above 25,000 feet, is deadly. Brain cells die, capillaries burst, the heart beats faster and blood begins to thicken. At this altitude, the body is also vulnerable to hypothermia, frostbite, cerebral and pulmonary edema, all of which can be fatal. The risks are vastly increased without the use of additional oxygen. By 1924, Mallory had grudgingly accepted the need for gaseous aid to climb Everest. Even today, many climbers believe climbing without it is aesthetically preferable. Previously, Mallory had believed that it was unsporting and, worse, un-British. But the life-giving canisters had drawbacks of their own. They were rudimentary, temperamental, and worst of all, heavy, 32 pounds per set. Mallory grumbled in his final note that it was a bloody load for climbing. At this altitude, everything is exhausting and slow. The mind is impaired, and even the slightest impediments to easy movement and speed are undesirable. Mallory knew this. He told the New York Times that during his previous trip, his companions had been able to climb no more than 330 feet in an hour, every inch of which had been hard won. He chafed against the dismal weight of the heavy shoes they wore through thick snow, and very likely chose Irvine as his climbing partner because of the latter's technical skill and inventiveness with the oxygen canisters. The young climber spent the afternoon of the 4th of June retesting and putting the final touches to the oxygen apparatus in order to make them as light and easy to carry as possible. In Mallory's final note to Odell, he said that he planned to only take 2 oxygen cylinders with him to Camp 6 for the final climb, likely as a concession to his desire for speed. His clothes reflected his blitzkrieg strategy. The Burberry jacket featured a patented pivot sleeve, specially designed for the greatest range of movement, without displacing the precious pockets of warm air trapped between the layers beneath. And although he wore a lot of layers, they were all light. They would be perfectly warm high on the mountain when active, but would not do for any length of time if the climbers had to remain stationary. If Odell was right, and a storm did blow in during the early afternoon, Mallory's clothes, coupled with a gritted-teeth diet of patriotism, heroism, and sang-froid, may have been his undoing. Odell hinted of this in the article he wrote on his return to England. Mallory had stated he would take no risks in any attempt on the final peak, he wrote. But in action, the desire to overcome, the craving for victory, may have been too strong for him. Who of us that has wrestled with some alpine giant in the teeth of a gale or in a race with the darkness could hold back when such a victory, such a triumph of human endeavour, was within our grasp? Blood, sweat, and frozen tears. Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful. A newspaper advertisement traditionally attributed to Ernest Shackleton, 1913. The human body is ill-equipped to handle the cold. The average body temperature is 37 degrees Celsius. Even a slight drop can be serious. Many of the chemical reactions central to healthy bodily functions only occur within a narrow temperature range. If the body falls to 35 degrees, it will initiate a range of measures to protect itself and prevent further heat loss. Blood vessels, particularly in the extremities, will constrict. The core must be kept warm, even at the expense of other parts of the body. The sufferer will begin to shiver, an attempt to generate heat, and the metabolic rate will increase, burning up more resources to power yet more shivering. Breathing will slow, blood pressure will decrease, and the heartbeat become irregular. Those suffering hypothermia will feel tired, confused, and argumentative. Fingers and toes might start to feel numb, affecting dexterity. They might begin to stumble. Their decision-making may become impaired. The physical misery of inadequate clothing seeps from explorers' accounts. Every movement is effortful, particularly through deep snow and fierce winds, or indeed at high altitudes. In a letter to his wife Ruth on the 17th of August 1921, Mallory wrote that it was only possible to keep plodding on by a tremendous and continually conscious effort of the lungs, and up the steep final slopes, I found it necessary to stop and breathe as hard as I could for a short space in order to gain sufficient energy to push up a few more steps. Paul Larson, who wore period clothing for a recreation of the harrowing 800 nautical mile journey from Antarctica to South Georgia Island, first completed by Shackleton in 1916, found his Burberry-style outer layer was windproof but insufficiently waterproof. Once natural fibres become wet, they become drastically less insulating, significantly heavier, and are difficult to dry out. Perhaps the most persistent and depressing problems were caused by perspiration. With so much physical exertion, tramping through snow, climbing, and trekking, explorers were drenched with it. The trouble, as Cherry Garrard put it, is sweat and breath. I never knew before how much of the body's waste comes out through the pores of the skin. And all this sweat, instead of passing away through the porous wool of our clothing and gradually drying off us, froze and accumulated. Not only did this result in ice forming between layers of clothing, soldering scarves to faces and socks to feet, and reducing the insulation of clothes still further, but it could also freeze cloth garments and objects into icy, unusable sculptures. Later in his book, he recounts an incident when he emerged from his tent in clothing still wet from the exertions of the day before. Once outside, I raised my head to look round and found I could not move it back. My clothing had frozen hard as I stood, perhaps 15 seconds. From that time we all took care to bend down into a pulling position before being frozen in. Edmund Hillary spent the first hours on the morning of his victorious ascent of Everest in 1953 thawing his boots. They were frozen solid, and I cooked them over the Primus stove until they were soft enough for me to pull on, he later recalled. We were wearing every piece of clothing we possessed. His clothes, though, were relatively modern and made of synthetic materials. The woolen clothing of the earlier explorers was highly absorbent and slow to dry, particularly when too tight-fitting. On a short expedition to Cape Crozier in July 1911, Scott's companion Wilson wrote despairingly that, with all this clothing wet and all frozen stiff, it becomes difficult to move with one's customary agility, and any climbing up ropes or climbing out of crevices becomes exceedingly difficult. Night made things worse. The sleeping bags of the Scott expedition, made of reindeer skin and eiderdown, became so sodden that they would freeze as hard as iron bars. Attempts to roll them up would split the seams. The more sodden they were, the harder it was to dry them out, and the colder their occupants became. This inevitably meant wearing even more clothes, which in turn would dampen with sweat and turn icy. The men would wake up with their skin pruned and pale. Even getting into them was difficult and time-consuming. The explorers would have to thaw their way in, using their own body heat to soften the sleeping bags sufficiently so that they could ease into them, foot by foot, leg by leg. First thing on getting out of sleeping bags in the morning, wrote Cherry Garrard, we stuffed our personal gear into the mouth of the bag before it could freeze. This made a plug which, when removed, formed a frozen hole for us to push into as a start in the evening. Layers of clothing, no matter what they are made of, are cumbersome and difficult to navigate when suffering the first effects of hypothermia or altitude sickness. John Krakauer, who summited Everest in the disastrous 1996 season, spent a morning blasted by a wind chill that dipped to perhaps 40 below zero. An extra jumper was in his backpack, but he despaired of the effort this would entail. I would first have to remove my gloves, pack, and wind jacket while dangling from a fixed rope. Kit lists produced for aspirant climbers spill much ink on the efficacy of vents, pockets, toileting options, and zip placement in down suits, and joust on the merits of different thermal tops, gloves, and socks, many made of complex mixtures of synthetics. Graham Hoyland, who tested replica Mallory clothes at altitude on Everest, found the fly buttons on the suit so impossible to navigate, he hypothesized that the earlier climber must have left his flies undone permanently. Lab tests done on these replicas, together with copies of Scott and Amundsen's gear, found that Scott's were so bulky and stiff that they would have required a huge amount of extra energy to move around in. During an enactment of the race in the Antarctic, four members of the team lost between 12 and 25% of their body weight, predominantly muscle mass. Another reenactment, this time taking place over the winter of 2013-14, found that the original Scott team's daily rations of pemmican, a mixture of dried beef and fat, fresh pony meat, biscuits and chocolate, had likely been between 2 and 3,000 calories short. The bodies of Scott and his companions were consuming themselves in an attempt to replenish the energy being expended hauling their kit through the snow towards the pole and keeping warm. If clothing fails to such an extent that the temperature of parts of the body falls below zero, the effects are dramatic. Frostbite is caused when ice crystals form in the skin and flesh. The first casualties are usually the tips of the ears and nose, fingers, hands, toes, feet, and male genitals. Numbness is the first symptom. The skin then blanches and mottles as ice crystals form. The afflicted area begins to feel woody to the touch, and, if the area is large enough, the blood turns to sludge. Although frostbite can be thawed and, in mild cases, the dead skin is shed and renews as it does under a blister, more serious cases mean amputation, even today. The alpinists of the early 20th century were no strangers to frostbite. Several of the 1922 Everest expedition suffered from it, exacerbated by their reliance on the kinds of clothing they would wear on the Alps. This was a mistake. The lack of oxygen, coupled with wind chill from the fierce gales that nearly always blow through the Himalayas above 21,000 feet, make it much harder to stay warm. Tragically, one solution had been discovered before both Mallory and Scott's expeditions, but perhaps because it looked decidedly unheroic, it had been rejected. Although the down of ducks and geese had long been used in quilted petticoats and bedding, no one had ever considered using them for cold weather clothing until George Finch had a suit made up to his own design, consisting of an eiderdown-lined coat, trousers and gauntlets, covered in balloon fabric. Finch, an Australian, was ridiculed by the snobbish Alpine Club, and his contemporaries refused to adopt the style, even when it proved far warmer than their own gear. Finch stuck to his guns, emphasizing the need for special clothing above this altitude in a 1923 Alpine Journal article. He suggested six or more layers of silk and wool, topped with a windproof layer, preferably lined with flannel, and covered with oiled silk. To protect hands, both so vulnerable and so vital for climbers, he suggested three layers: a woolen inner glove, a lambskin pair, and finally a waterproofed canvas pair. Today, when climbers wear down suits and synthetic fleece layers specifically designed for Everest, frostbite continues to stalk those who venture up the mountainside. During the 1996 climbing season, when eight people died in a single day in a blizzard at altitude, Beck Weathers, a Texan pathologist and amateur mountaineer, became so weak and impaired that he was left for dead with his face and hands exposed. He survived, but lost a third of his right arm, all five fingers on his left hand, his nose, and portions of both feet. Nearly all the members of the Scott expedition suffered from frostbite, making them more vulnerable to it later on, and the attacks more severe. At first, even though members of the team had Antarctic experience, they seemed blasé about the risks. In February 1911, Scott mentioned in his diary that one morning, Bowers ventured out into temperatures of minus 21 degrees Celsius, wearing his small felt hat, ears uncovered. After travelling just 1 mile, his ears had turned white with frostnip, and while he was relatively speedily thawed, his chief emotion was intense surprise and disgust at the mere fact of possessing such unruly organs. Negligence of this kind was potentially life-threatening. During the long march back from the South Pole, the men were slowed by the deplorable condition of Oates's feet and tired, defeated and rapidly wearing through their socks and finnesko, soft fur boots, all began to develop symptoms, slowing them down still further. Scott succumbed too just 10 days before his death. "My right foot has gone, nearly all the toes. 2 days ago, I was proud possessor of best feet." This was the 18th of March, and hopes of reaching safety were being snuffed out one by one. The next day, things were worse. "Amputation is the least I can hope for now. But will the trouble spread?" Kit lists. "The coldness cuts through as though we were naked. Fingers are soon numb, but still alive enough to hurt, which is good. Toes and nose likewise. The others wear the Eskimo wolfskin parkas, which still smell of bad mackerel." Sir Ranulph Fiennes, To the Ends of the Earth, 1982. "Since those first stumbling silk and wool clad climbers mapped routes up Everest in the 1920s, tens of thousands have reached base camp, and just under 7,000 climbers have reached the peak that cost Mallory and Irvine their lives in 1924. The price of a permit for foreigners is $11,000, and some pay up to $90,000 to firms that will help them attain this goal. Everest is now an industry. The government reaps over £3 million annually from climbers' permits. 15,000 kilograms of climbers' rubbish has been removed in a 6-year clean-up. 11,000 kilograms of frozen excrement is carted away annually. Similar pressures bear on Antarctica. Explorers and amateurs vie for ever obscurer accolades. The first person to cycle to the South Pole. The first Indian woman to ski there. The ability of more people to reach these areas is due in part to the huge step change in fabrics available. Mountaineers and explorers have, for the past 50 years, heavily relied on synthetics unavailable to Mallory and Scott. For his ascent of Everest in 1996, for example, John Krakauer zipped his body into 3 layers of fuzzy polypropylene pile underwear and an outer shell of windproof nylon. When George Finch created his prototype eiderdown and balloon silk suit, he was laughed at. By the time Edmund Hillary made his ascent in 1953, down suits were considered essential. Down insulation is made from the fine, fluffy plumage that keeps geese and ducks warm, sandwiched between 2 fine layers of fabric. It works by trapping layers of insulating air among the feathers, but it is still light and breathable. The major drawback of down is that, once wet, the feathers clump together, losing their loft, fluffiness, and therefore their ability to trap heat. Synthetic down is made from polyester fibres that mimic the air-trapping qualities of the natural stuff. It's more resistant to moisture and dries within hours, unlike the natural version, but it is heavier and more cumbersome. The ideal, therefore, is a waterproof, windproof layer over a down suit, but this too, for a long time, proved difficult to create. Gore-Tex has, since the late 1970s, become the near ubiquitous answer to the problem of clothing that is both breathable and waterproof. Created by the American father and son W.L. Gore firm in 1969, Gore-Tex is made from a layer of finely stretched Teflon, polytetrafluoroethylene or PTFE, bonded to nylon or polyester. At a microscopic level, the stretched PTFE resembles caramel honeycomb. The pores are large enough to allow water vapor out, but too small to allow liquid droplets in. W.L. Gore sells their fabric to outdoor apparel firms like Berghaus, Mountain Equipment, and North Face, and for the moment, reigns supreme. Paul Larson, the Australian sailor who set a new nautical speed record in 2012 and participated in the recreation of a Shackleton sea voyage the following year, swears by it. Modern clothing, he said of the latter experience, would have made the trip a doddle. A modern Gore-Tex dry suit is a very comfortable piece of kit that you can easily spend a lot of time in. Instead, he was encased in a coated Burberry-style cotton smock. Bit by bit, the water got in until you had to admit you were simply drenched from head to foot. Worse still, the smock took 3 full days to dry properly. Gore-Tex does, nevertheless, have its drawbacks. Like all synthetic shells, it can be a little slow to allow sweat to evaporate, a problem for those working hard who don't want to soak and therefore compromise their base layers. For drier conditions, or when breathability is paramount, there is a strong incentive to cast around for an alternative. Perhaps the only place where natural fibres are still preferred in the world's least forgiving environments is next to the skin. Even this concession was hard won. Although still commonly used in the 1950s, by the mid-1960s, synthetics had conquered the market after something of a rout. While in 1953, Edmund Hillary's layers still included a woolen shirt, underwear, and Shetland wool pullover, by the 1990s this seemed so old-fashioned as to be eccentric, even dangerous. Synthetic velour, championed by brands including Helly Hansen and Patagonia, was becoming the norm. To Conrad Anker, the American climber who found Mallory's body in 1999, the latter's natural fibre underlayers were anathema. Even as late as 2006, Graham Hoyland, the climber who used Mallory-era clothing at altitude on Everest, was surprised by his experience of using natural fibres. "Like most mountaineers," he wrote, "I am used to synthetic outdoor clothing, polypropylene underclothes and outer fleeces. They are unforgiving in stretch and begin to smell unpleasant if worn for more than a couple of days." For him, Mallory's silk, cotton and wool layers were a pleasant revelation. The past 2 decades, however, have seen a reversion. Icebreaker, a New Zealand brand, was founded in 1995 specifically as an antidote to the synthetic fibres that had, in just a few decades, swallowed the outdoor clothing market whole. The firm specialises in merino wool base layers and is now recommended on several Everest kit lists. The sailor Paul Larson generally chooses to wear natural fibre underwear under his Gore-Tex during his expeditions. His current favourite base layers are made of yak wool. This renewed acceptance of natural fibres has run parallel to a reappraisal of the Mallory and Scott expeditions. Although they were both considered tragic heroes by their own generation, the dominant narratives since have been less kind. Mallory's legacy has come to be defined by 2 things. The first is the unprovable what-if speculation that he may have been the first man to reach Everest's summit. The second is the photographs of his naked, unburied body taken and sold to the press by members of the expedition that found it in 1999. Scott has also fallen from grace. In a 2011 National Geographic article on Scott's rival entitled "The Man Who Took the Prize," The author pointedly wrote that while he was prey to the ambition, dreams and impulses that drive all explorers, Amundsen's greatness, her word, is that he mastered them. Scott, on the other hand, is often caricatured as a foolish, ill-prepared and, mired in an outdated colonial worldview, ignorant of or too quick to dismiss the fur clothing favoured by indigenous people. This last point is something Scott addressed directly. An entry in his journals, written in August 1911 before the start of the final journey, foreshadows his end. Ill-equipped and poorly clothed, in the least hospitable environment on Earth. One continues to wonder as to the possibility of fur clothing as made by the Eskimo, with a sneaking feeling that it may outclass our civilized garb. For us, this can only be a matter of speculation, as it would have been quite impossible to have obtained such articles.